Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
And the reason I want to start with Sean Payton is this. Sean Payton is one of the great offensive minds in the history of the NFL. Now, that's not exaggeration. That's not hyperbole. It's a fact. If you're a football fan, you know this. If you're a hardcore football fan, getting a look at Sean Payton's playbook would be one of the coolest things ever. But you know what would be even better than getting inside Sean Payton's playbook? Getting inside Sean Payton's playbook and hearing where some of the terms come from. Now, if you're on Twitter, you get both. And the origin of the terms is so much better than I would have hoped. It all started when Bobby Peters posted a tweet which read, quote, "Let's start a fun thread. Post one of your favorite all-purpose concepts out of empty. Here's one of mine. Gets the ball out of the quarterback's hands quickly and can leverage most coverages." Then he included a diagram of the play. I like that. That's cool. And that's when Twitter is good. So that's cool. And sure enough, there were responses. And responses from credible guys like Dan Orlovsky and Case Keenum. They weighed in, and then so did Sean Payton. And Sean Payton brought the goods. I knew he would. His first play, quote, "Gun empty, right Quizno, 52 all go, special X shallow cross, four verticals, or find Michael Thomas, X." And then he included a diagram they sketched out on a notebook or a piece of notebook paper. I love that the play call is really long, but the explanation is really short. Find Michael Thomas. That could be pretty much every single play call, right? That's how good Michael Thomas is. Hey, you nine guys, do whatever the hell you want. Drew, you find Michael Thomas. And the fact that Payton just jumped in and started firing off picks of the plays is awesome. As he told Mike Triplett, quote, "I quickly drew one up on paper and took a picture of one of our plays, posted it, then just continued." And my man did. He got nice. He kept right on going. Quote, "Gun empty, right Quizno, 52 nudge, all HB choice, got to get Alvin Kamara a touch." That's a mouthful, right? And speaking of a mouthful, did you notice a pattern in the naming? Like the fact that Quizno is in the play call. That's not an accident. That's not the hunger talking. That's the playbook talking. Payton tweeted, quote, "We use sandwich terms for tight splits. JJ equals Jimmy Johns. Club, stack, Quizno, at Quiznos." Pretty cool, right? And wait a minute, though. Jersey Mike's didn't want any of that? How do you leave out Jersey Mike's? Nothing in the playbook for Panera? Nothing for Arby's? And that incredible sauce they have? Is Togo's getting shut out of this? What about Witch? I'll tell you what, Sean. You're my guy. You're a genius. One of the best play callers ever. One of the most brilliant offensive minds ever. But my man, you better have something in there for Wiener Schnitzel. That's a guaranteed house call right there. Wiener Schnitzel. Man, that play card looks like a giant menu. And it's actually got food on it. Please tell me that the rub routes are all named after barbecue joints. Tell me there's at least one play call that references Denny's. I mean, what is there not to love about this clinic? My only regret is that food did not get worked into every single play call, because Payton then posted another play that had no food references. Quote, "Gun bombers right, 352, Y shock, X Lucy." But he made up for the lack of sandwiches on that play by laying out the history behind it. Quote, "Jerry Rice mastered this looky option route, Lucy. Great compliment, especially against Jimmy Johnson quarters coverage." There you go. Lucy means a looky route. And if it's Jerry Rice running that looky route or looky option, he's going to crush it. And if you're wondering what the 352 means, Payton cleared that up too. Quote, 52 is five-man protection, 352 is simply a three-step drop five-man protection. And there it is, a free masterclass in offense and on Twitter. And of course, because we can never, ever have anything nice, somebody had to jump in and try and put an end to the whole thing. Quote, somebody please unquarantine at Sean Payton before this man spills all the offense on Twitter. Coach, you know Todd Bowles, Raheem Morris, and Eric Washington can see this, right? End quote. You knew that was coming. Of course, that had to come. Somebody had to jump in and try and put a stop to all of our fun before some of the D coordinators in the NFC South might see Peyton's posts. To which Peyton responded, quote, they've been seeing this. Hell yes. That's how you handle that. They've been seeing this. They've been seeing it for years. Besides, Peyton's not giving away any secrets. He's not giving away any state secrets here. He's showing a couple of base plays. One that's from Jerry Rice. One that's practically called Find Michael Thomas. And one that's about getting Alvin Kamara a touch. I don't think he's telling us anything that the entire world didn't already know. Get the ball to Michael Thomas. Get the ball into Alvin Kamara's hands. I'm pretty sure Todd Bowles and Raheem Morris have seen all those plays a million times already. And if it'll make you feel any better, Eric Washington is now in Buffalo, so that's no longer an enormous worry for the Saints either. Bowles and Morris are not going to suddenly be screenshotting those tweets and then handing them out to their players when the teams reassemble. Again, their base looks, they're pretty cool to you and I, but to everybody else, they're nothing. It's vanilla. He's not giving away any information. Do you really think that Sean Payton would just be hanging out at home, firing off picks of the playbook and ruining the Saints' season? The hell he would. Sean Payton is way, way smarter than that. This is Sean Payton we're talking about, not Marcus Jordan. No way he's going to screw up on Twitter and then try to cover that up by coming back with, yo, anyway, what's poppin' Twitter? Hashtag Happy Sunday. Besides, it's not even the play calls. It's when you call them and how you execute them that really matters. So just thank Payton for that really cool session and go about your business and keep moving. Enjoy the diagrams, the explanations, and the sandwich references. Now, let's all get a GD snack.
Let's go to eat a goddamn snack.
From Wiener Schnitzel. Hey, I know, Saints fan, I know. I can see the email before you send it. I can stop those plays. Signed, the refs. Great stuff. Save it. Do not hit send. Delete. Do not keep a draft. No need. I know what you're thinking before you think it, because you're just not that clever. We are joined by LA Dodgers manager Dave Roberts. Dave, it's good to have you back. How are you?
Romy, under the circumstances, I'm doing pretty well. I'm spending a lot of time with family and catching up on some shows, probably eating and drinking a little too much, but, life is good as far as the family. Thank you for having me.
I was just going to ask you that very question, Dave. It sounds like the rest of us, too, probably eating and drinking too much, but if there is a silver lining, it is that we are getting caught up with the family. How is your family time? What's that like for you?
Yeah, you know what? It's actually, been good. And I know you have a young college student, and I have one who now is doing online classes from Loyola Marymount, ball player. And I've got a sophomore daughter. And so to kind of get us all back under the same roof has actually been a treat. We just don't expect that time, outside of a holiday going forward. And so that's been really good. And the kids have been engaged and, the family dinners, and they're helping around the house. So obviously watching shows and doing things, we're in the kitchen together. So that's been fun, walking dogs, obviously being very mindful of what's going on out in our world. But, no sports, so I'm missing baseball, but still, staying active as much as we can. So that's been good. And Romy, to be quite honest, looking around our country and you see people helping, athletes, celebrities, and – you know, being positive. And for me, honestly, I think this is an opportunity. And I was talking to my wife earlier, Roman, I don't want to babble, but I was just talking to my wife, and you've been that kind of pillar of positivity and celebrating people in sports. And it's kind of now where there's been a cynical thing in sports and kind of a certain take, where I think that people being positive today and when we need the levity and the positivity has been great.
It's so nice of you to say that, Dave, and I appreciate that, and I agree with you so wholeheartedly. We do need that right now. We need some positivity. We need some levity. I mean, it's a really serious situation, and it needs to be treated as such, and we are, but we do need to be upbeat, and I tend to see it the same way as you. It's a really troubling time and a challenging time, but there is an opportunity, and there is a way to get better throughout. You know, you mentioned you're watching shows. I want to talk baseball, of course. What shows are you watching?
All right. So we watched this movie, Knives Out. We watched that. That was good. We are on the 911 Lone Star because Rob obviously is a Dodger fan and trying to support him. And that's been good. And then I'm getting into this this Tiger show. So some of my players are watching this thing that and I think that I was listening to you a little bit earlier, so the spoiler alert, I turned you off because I'm only in episode two. So I don't know which way it's going to go. I mean, it's bad, it's troubling, but I just can't stop watching it, right? So that's probably what I'm watching most.
I appreciate it. Dave Roberts is joining us, LA Dodgers manager. All right, so you've made the point that when you're in spring training, you're in something of a bubble because you're focused on baseball and the upcoming season. So what's it like, or what's it been like to gear up for the season? From the outside, it seemed like the team was having such a successful spring training, and then you have to shut it down immediately, and then you have to get ready for opening day in a very different way. The whole process is so unusual. What's that been like?
It's crazy. And I was at the 94 strike. I got drafted in 1994. So then there's rumblings of an agreement, you know, that kind of might shut some things down. And I was still a young player, a minor league player at that point in time. But this is a situation where all the focus is getting ready for a major league season. And, you know, Mookie and David and Blake Trinan, all these guys that are new to us, we've kind of assimilated, we're feeling good, we're healthy going in, and this kind of caught us all, you know, by surprise. And obviously it started, you know, in Asia and Europe, and it kind of gets us, but again, we were in that bubble and don't really think that it could affect us. So the next thing you know, we're kind of being evacuated, everyone's told to go home, facility shut down, and you know, and now everyone's kind of caught trying to figure out what the heck we do. And I've mentioned before, Romy, it's baseball players, athletes, and a lot of us kind of work in the guidelines of if there's a start time, end time, we can do whatever it takes in between, but we just need to know that certainty. And right now, we just don't have that.
Right, exactly. Dave Roberts, my guest. I mean, as you pointed out, players are creatures of habit. They like to know what their schedule is. They have a structure. So what's your sense as to what your guys are doing and the kind of work they're putting in right now, and how challenging is it to get that work in and stay in shape?
I think that is, and managing a big league ball club or being a head coach, it's managing men. You know, or women, you know, whatever sports. But it's like, for me, it's staying connected to these guys. And I think that right now, first and foremost, you know, the health, the spending time with the family, your wife, your kids, fiance, you know, parents, if you're with your folks. But try to keep your mind sharp, your body active, you know, your arm with the starting pitchers, keep that moving. Your obliques, your core with the positional players, as far as you don't want to come back and blow out an oblique, and kind of understanding that this is unprecedented. And so with that, spring training, when and if we do have it, it's going to be abbreviated. The season, we're talking doubleheaders and all this kind of stuff potentially. So we got to be nimble. And so I think as for us, we got to do, you know, whatever we can to kind of stay as sharp as we can with health at the forefront.
We're talking to Dave Roberts. All right, so if the spring training, and it will be abbreviated, how much time do you think guys are going to need, especially pitchers, to get ready for the start of the season, whenever that is?
I think for me, and this is, and I say me, this is after talking to position players, pitchers, I think 2 weeks. I think that, you know, once we get that soft opening or soft start for a spring training, then I think guys will have time to really start to ramp up. So then when we do get there, 2 weeks will suffice. And I do think that also you know, with the understanding that the rosters are going to be expanded, where there's got to be extra pitchers, a handful, if not more. And you've got to have that latitude to kind of, you know, when the spring training we've talked about before, where the reentry rule for pitchers to go out after 15, 20 pitches to go bring somebody else in to get Clayton Kershaw back in there so he can get ramped up, because the fans, they want to see the stars. So they've got to give managers, organizations, whatever latitude we need to get the superstars out there and the players out there once we get going.
We are talking to L.A. Dodgers manager Dave Roberts. So, Dave, a few things about the team. You mentioned Clay Kershaw. He had been announced as the opening day starter. Obviously, a lot of things have changed since that time, and we don't really know when opening day is going to be. But what did you see from him that let you know that he was ready to be the opening day starter once again?
I think that the way his body was moving, Romy, he did this thing that was kind of – that's been talked about, this thing, place called Driveline up there in the Northwest. And he went there, Kenley went there, and Clayton, you know, will never admit to any type of weakness or soreness or pains. But he's been dealing with it for the last few years. And just so, you know, to see his body and talking to strength guys, conditioning guys, training staff, see his body work independently, but the core being so strong. Romy, I haven't seen him look this good in quite some time. And just his command, the velocity ticked up. The breaking ball was what it was with the depth. So we were really looking forward to him having a great year. Walker Buehler is right there with them. So for us to feel we got a 1-1A is pretty remarkable. And obviously you mix in David Price too. So it's pretty fun.
Dave Roberts is joining us. All right, in terms of David Price, obviously, Dave, the team acquired Mookie Betts and David Price. As manager, what was your reaction when the trade was official and you knew you were going to have them in your clubhouse?
It was a loud yell. It was a popping of champagne because, man, it just doesn't happen. We're guys in their prime. You know, you've got a former Cy Young winner who is thrilled to be a Dodger and to be on the West Coast, spent his entire career on the East Coast in David Price. And then you've got arguably the best player, you know, obviously Mike Trout, and right behind him is Mookie Betts, who is in his prime and happy to be a Dodger. So you get that just doesn't happen to a team that won 106 games. So you hear about the makeup, the work ethic, all this stuff, and you look at the back of the baseball card. So I was obviously thrilled.
Hey, Dave, one thing about Mookie Betts, there was a story back in February that he spoke to the entire team. David Price said that he had been with Mookie for years and he had never seen him put his heart out the way he did in that speech. What do you make of what he said?
You know what? It was ridiculous, Romy. I got a text from him the night before, and it was the first meeting of full squad workouts. And then he wanted the floor for a few minutes after I spoke. And the second thing he asked me, and I said, no problem. I didn't need to hear what the topic was going to be about. You just trust the player. And the second thing he wanted was Clayton Kershaw's cell phone. So I forwarded that to him. And then so I spoke, and it was just more of just, in the best, most respectful way, calling us out, a call to urgency, the little things, and day one of spring training needs to be mirrored as if it was game seven of the World Series. And that's what they did in 18 and led to a championship. And it was very just the message was the right message, and it was kind of likened to, I guess, a tempered version of what Kirk Gibson did to the Dodgers and his teammates in 1988. So it was great. And I'll tell you this, Romy, is a player that doesn't have the equity in an organization or a ball club, and as you look out, is only committed to 1 year and then he's free, it just doesn't happen. So that speaks to where David Price said it's unprecedented for Mookie to come out there and put his reputation, his neck out on the line, and it just shows what a leader he is.
Dave Roberts joining me for another moment or so. So what about David Price? Dave, this is a big David Price house. I'm a big fan. I've always been a big fan of his. What's it been like to work with him so far, and how did he look?
He was on point. It's amazing is you see him when he pitches and you see the focus. You see him with his teammates and what every single teammate that's ever played with him or staff member that's been around him, they sing his praises. But to see this guy work, he's very surgical. He's like Clayton in the sense of the focus and what he does and how serious he takes his craft. So he was good. He's very kind of seeing things and trying to get the landscape, but you could just see really early on that guys are gravitating towards him, and he's going to have a huge year for him.
Dave Roberts, my guest. Dave, do me a favor before you go. You have to do this. We don't have to do anything, but if I were to ask you about your time as a player, you did talk to MLB.com about the steal, the stolen base in game four of the 04 ALCS. Can you, without getting into the whole thing, can I just ask you about that? For game four, you enter in the ninth. Everybody in the world knows what you're there to do. Mariano Rivera throws over the first three times. Can you at least tell me what was going through your head in that moment?
You know what, real quick, Roman, I appreciate you bringing it up. And you know me, I'm as humble as you are. We don't like to talk about things like that ourselves. But it was just one of those things where you've got the Maury Wills on one side, who was my mentor when I was with the Dodgers in 2002 as a young major league player, telling me you're going to have a chance and an opportunity and you can't be afraid. And on the other side, I've got the Bill Buckner on the other side saying, you know, if you make a mistake, you get thrown out, then the Red Sox nation is going to hate you forever and you're going to cost the team a chance to play in the World Series. And I just felt preparation and opportunity led to success. And I was ready for that moment and I wasn't afraid to take it. And I was surrounded by a great group of guys, a great organization. I was lucky to be a part of it, Rob.
Can we just, and I understand this, you don't want to make it about you. You've told the story before, Dave, but I just have to make the point. When you do take off, Jorge Posada throws down to second with a pop time of 1.7 seconds. That was the fastest he had gotten it down to second all season long, and you still beat it. What do you remember about that moment?
What I do remember is the three throwovers. The first one kind of calmed my nerves. The second one felt like I was playing in the days preceding. And then the last one, I felt like I had just played eight innings and I was locked in. So I knew that he was going to hold the baseball to try to deter me from stealing. And so I had a huge lead because Maury always said, get your maximum lead. So I had a huge lead. I got in my signature crouch. And once you deliver that baseball, Romy, it's like a home run hitter that knows they got it. When I had that jump, I knew I got him. And regardless of the pop time, the pitch location. But I will say this, I didn't realize how close that dang play was. And I've said this and joked about it many times, is that every time I watch that clip, it seems like it gets closer and closer. So hopefully, down the road, Joe West doesn't change his call.
Dude, I was going to say, stop watching it, Dave. They're going to get you one of these times. He's the manager of the LA Dodgers. 5 years in, he is the 2016 NL Manager of the Year. He won a World Series as a player. The Dodgers coming off that 106-win season. Dave, I appreciate you so much. Stay safe. Great to have you back, and I hope we can do it again soon.
All the best, Romy. Thanks for having me on.
And in times as unpredictable as these, two of the most predictable things happened over the weekend, which is nice. Joe Exotic went Joe Exotic, and Big Sexy went Big Sexy.
I'm sexy and I know it.
Big Sexy. Right when you need him. A.K.A. Bartolo Colon.
Sexy and I know it.
Remember, he retired in 2018. He left a 285-pound void in the baseball world. Last we saw of this guy, he was absorbing 101-mile-per-hour comebackers off his gut and hosing runners at first. Oh, and dropping second deck moonshots with a flick of the wrist.
Colon looking for his first hit of the year. Oh. He drives one deep left field. That goes Upton back near the wall. It's out of here. Bartolo has done it. The impossible has happened.
Impossible. Have you not seen this guy? The 21-year career of Bart Colon was an all-out flex show. Of a guy who looked like he couldn't do anything, doing absolutely everything. So it should come as no surprise whatsoever to anybody that Big Sexy posted some videos to the gram over the weekend of him showing off that uncanny, unbelievable, unparalleled athletic prowess yet again, but this time at the pool table. Now, that super ambiguous piece of audio is the sound of Bart emptying the clip on billiards trick shots. That's right. Bartolo Colon is a trick shot artist at the pool table, which, of course, he is. Now, I understand that you can't see it. I understand this is not exactly visual medium, but do you really need to see it to believe it? It's freaking Big Sexy. If I told you he was rolling rocks in the pocket, you best take my word for it. Who would question that? Bart posted three separate videos of three separate trick shots on the felt, each one even more impressive than the next, each one ending with an emphatic drop of the stick. My favorite part isn't even the trick shots themselves, or the fact that he decided to share them with a world on lockdown that desperately needed to see them. No, the best part, and my favorite part, is that he used the caption TBT. TBT on all three videos. As you probably know, TBT stands for Throwback Thursday. It's an excuse to post an older picture or an older vid on a certain day of the week. Except that Bart posted his TBTs on Saturday, which is pretty amazing. Because Saturday is Saturday. It's not Thursday. Saturday starts with an S. So my man did a throwback Thursday on Sabado. He did it on Saturday. Three of them, in fact. I don't know. I guess what I'm getting at is, do you really think the rules of social media apply to Big Sexy? Hell no, they don't. I'll take Billiards Bart any day of the week. And this guy can caption it with a football emoji for all I care. It's good to see you, Big Sexy. Good to see you. I'm already looking forward to your next TBT this coming Saturday of you picking up a 7-10 split. Can't wait. Man, I miss that guy. Like, I miss baseball, but he's bigger than baseball. He transcends baseball. I really miss that. So that was something we had. And then, of course, there was Joe Exotic. Joe Exotic going Joe Exotic. And if you don't know Joe Exotic, then you do not have the internet. It's as simple as that. This guy is still about the most famous person on the planet right now because he is the star of the most watched piece of content in the past month. Of course, I'm talking about Tiger King. Legit spoiler alert for anybody paying rent under a rock right now. The spoiler is coming in 3, 2, and 1. No, again, some of you can't get out of your own way. If you have not seen this to its conclusion, the spoiler is coming in 3, 2, and 1. I'm going to give you one more shot. 3, 2, 1. So Joey X is currently in jail, and he's looking at a 22-year stretch. And I have to spoil that part to tell you this part. As of Sunday, he filed a $100 million lawsuit, a long shot lawsuit, against the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He also asked Donald Trump for a presidential pardon. Yeah, I'm pretty certain that the government might be a little too busy right now with another developing situation. But that doesn't mean that I don't want to hear an official statement from the White House on our man Joe Exotic. Even if it's just them saying, no, we are not going to pardon Mr. Exotic from his stretch. That'd be nice. But that's not even the best part. That's not even the best bit of Joe Exotic news from the weekend. Apparently, the worst-kept secret in the world is out. You might want to find a chair for this one. You might want to sit down to hear this. All right, so you know Joe Exotic. And my man's just, he's wild. He's wild, but he's talented, right? I mean, this dude, not only is he running that crazy exotic zoo, not only does he look and sound the way he does, my man is an artist. My man is a musician. This guy's crazy. Like, he writes and composes music. You've seen the music videos. Like, there's never been a dude like this before, right? Joe was not actually singing or writing the songs that he made those music videos for. No way. I can't believe that the guy who sounds like this.
Check out our other website and our other television station. Joe Gone Wild. Damn, that hurt.
All right, so you know how sometimes you hear about artists and singers and they've got a certain accent, and then they sing, and then you can't hear that accent. Do that again. That first guy, Rit. The first guy. The guy who sounds like this.
Check out our other website and our other television station. Joe Gone Wild. Damn, that hurt.
All right, you're going to tell me that guy. I can't believe that guy with that voice and that dialect isn't the guy who sings like this.
Because I saw a tiger, now I understand. I saw a tiger, tiger saw a man. I can give him a home, safe and warm.
That guy's not that guy. No way.
Me.
First of all, it's like a ripoff, isn't it, of I Saw a Cat, Mate? I mean, there's got to be some kind of trademark suit there, too. So the group behind the crazy dude with the bleached blonde mullet is called the Clinton Johnson Band. And they told TMZ that Joey X would send them an idea or a theme, and then the band would take it and run with it from there. So what makes that reveal somewhat shocking is that Joe Exotic's most famous song is called Here Kitty Kitty, which is a ballad all about how his rival, Carole Baskin, killed her first husband and then fed his remains to a tiger, allegedly.
Here Kitty Kitty, mama's got some treats for you. Taste in the zoo. Oh, here, kitty, kitty. Oh, Mama Carol, she sure loved you. Oh, here, kitty, kitty. Oh, Mama made this for you.
Incredible, man. That's not really Joe. And just kind of think about that for a second. Joe Exotic sends this band a few notes on his theory that a woman hates her guts. That a woman that they don't know iced her husband, put him through a meat grinder, and then fed him to a tiger. The band gets those notes, presumably doesn't ask any questions, and then just starts jamming. Just starts jamming. Probably sat down and just wrote that song on a napkin. Hey, Joe. Here you go, Joe. Oh, yeah, we got this one, Joe. Here's that song about that cold case murder you asked us for. Here's that song about Carol. Hey, Joe, why don't you give this a little spin? Let us know how this sounds.
Kitty, kitty. Oh, Mama's got some treats for you. Oh, here, kitty, kitty. You can't find this taste in the zoo. Oh,
hey, 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 fellas.
Kitty, kitty.
Fellas, just got off the phone with Joe.
Oh,
wait till you get a load of this one. Oh, man, I love that guy. I can't wait. How much is he paying us again? He's not feeding us that spoiled meat that they got from the store. We got to go through the trash cans, is he? Oh, no, we get paid for this. That's when that series started to take a turn for me. Like, it started off, like, really weird and kooky. Until I found out that not only was he feeding the cats spoiled meat, but his employees as well. From a Walmart. But anyway, I'm sure these guys in the band are like, yo, just got the phone with Joe. Get a load of this one. Now he wants a song about this woman that whacked her husband, put her through a meat grinder, and fed her to one of the cats that she says she cares so much about. That she charges admission to people to see, but doesn't pay her staff because they're there because they love the animal. And she's not a hypocrite. Ready? To tune up that axe. Let's do this. Here, kitty, kitty.
Here, kitty, kitty.
Even the freaking ghost band in the documentaries out there. Speaking of Joe Exotic, somehow Shaq O'Neal got wrapped up in this whole thing. If you've been watching, Shaq got wrapped up in a bit of controversy because he was featured in the doc for a brief moment when he showed up at the Oklahoma Zoo. Now, obviously, given what everybody knows now, that's not a great look for Shaq, right? You know, Shaq's there. He's having a good time. He's chipping off money. He's making donations, handling the little kitties. And people were coming at him pretty hard. Shaq said on his podcast that once he found out exactly what Joe Exotic was involved in, he stopped going to the zoo. And that was well before the doc dropped on Netflix. Shaq also said, quote, "I don't harm tigers. I love tigers. I love white tigers. Do I put donations to these zoos to help these tigers out? I do it all the time. Do I own tigers personally in my house? No. But I love tigers. Listen, people are going to make their own opinions. But again, I was just a visitor. I met this guy. Not my friend. Don't know him. Never had any business dealings with him." Weird. I don't know, man. I don't know how you show up at a place like that and look around and not think, damn, something's not right. And by something, I mean everything. But, Shaq said, "I had no idea, but as soon as I found out, I wanted nothing to do with it." I mean, when you watch it and you see the little cubs, they are kind of, sort of cute for a few moments until you start thinking about, all right, what's going on here? What's really going on here? Tiger captivity. And then you see what's really going on as you continue to watch it. And Joe's not cool. And Joe's not just kind of a different kooky guy. Joe's a scumbag. So I guess Shaq figured it out. Better late than ever, big fella. Joe Exotic is not a hero. He's a dirtbag. He didn't even write his own music. And he's in jail for a long time because of it. In fact, they're all dirtbags. Wild times. They're all dirtbags except Bart. Bart's big sexy. Michael Brockers is my guest. Michael, good to have you back. How are you?
Man, I'm doing great. Doing great. How are you doing with all this craziness?
You know what? Just like everybody else, Michael, I appreciate you saying that. Hanging in there, spending time with the family, still doing the show, which feels great. So just kind of grinding through the thing, trying to stay positive and upbeat. Michael, your situation's been wild of late. What an interesting period it's been for you. Initially, there were reports that you agreed to that deal with the Ravens. Let me ask you about that really quickly. At that time, what was it about the opportunity in Baltimore that appealed to you? What did you like about that?
Well, you know, just the opportunity to play with a team that I felt like, you know, had a chance to go all the way. And at that time, you know, they were offering me a little bit higher than what the Rams were offering me. And I just thought it was the best decision for, you know, me and my family with financially and also being, you know, having a chance to possibly get to the playoffs and win, you know, go to the Super Bowl.
I get that. Michael Brockers is my guest. I get that. But then what's it like when you go from thinking that you're leaving the Rams, the team that drafted you, to play in Baltimore, but now you're back with the Rams and you have a 3-year deal? What's that feel like?
Man, it feels awesome, man. I'm a man that a religious man, and I feel like everything happens in a way that God plans it. And, you know, for me, at first, you know, I thought that was my next journey was Baltimore, but ultimately, he had a plan to keep me in L.A. and, you know, around the people I'm used to, the coaches that love me, and I love them back. And, you know, man, just appreciate working for these guys.
We're talking to Michael Brockers. You know, you're entering your ninth season now in the NFL. The vast majority of guys who enter the NFL never last that long, and even smaller number spends 9 years or more at the same team. So how much pride is there in the fact that not only have you had the career you've had, but you are doing it all with the same team?
It's definitely just a testament just to just a blessing, man. I can't put any, you know, name to it or any word to it. Man, I just, you know, continue just to come in to work, grab my hard hat and just enjoy what we do, man. Because like you said before, a lot of people don't make it this long and don't make it to the league. So I'm definitely going to enjoy every day I have in it.
All right, so speaking of the hard hat, construction continues. You see what I did there? Construction continues on the team's new stadium with the expectation that it's going to open up this season. How much are you looking forward to that new stadium and getting to play in it?
Oh, man, definitely when we found out we were moving here and we were going to get a new stadium, my hopes were high that I would be able to play in it. And, you know, as it happens, you know, I got a new contract and I'll be opening up in there. So it's definitely going to be a great experience just to go from, you know, St. Louis and, you know, be in L.A. and open up in a new stadium.
No doubt. Michael Brocker is my guest. Now, that defense is going to be somewhat different because a number of faces are gone, including Wade Phillips. You and I have talked about the legendary son of Bum in the past. What was it like to play for him, and how much did you learn from him?
I learned a lot from him. I mean, you know, just to see a coach with such a background and he can just talk to you and just come to you as a man and laugh and chill. I mean, he was just awesome, man, just to see such a guy with a great resume. You know, some coaches take it into an ego thing and, you know, make themselves bigger than what they are, you know. He was definitely a humble coach, a humble experience, and I just love playing for him.
We're talking to Michael Brocker. You know, earlier in the offseason also, you were in the studio at the NFL Network, and you did some analyst work. I thought you made it look really easy, and you spent some time talking about some prospects. Let me ask you what you thought about Chase Young. In fact, I know, in a sense, you were talking about his mindset, his desire to be great. Why is that something that jumped out to you about him? What did you see when you saw him?
It just reminded me of AD. You know, AD has that mindset. It's not about the money. He definitely appreciates it. It's a blessing. But, you know, for him, is always dominating. It's never, you know, having a play where, you know, you feel like that was a bad play on my part or my bad. I mean, he's always chasing greatness, always trying to improve, always working. And he's not complacent. And that's what I love about him. And it motivates me.
Hey, Michael, what about that? Like, from the outside, people might think, yeah, well, but every single guy who comes into the league has got this desire to be great. But let me ask you, I mean, do they? Does every guy want it as badly as they have to want it in order to be great?
No, sir. It's definitely a difference between me and AD. Because sometimes I see him, I'm like, bro, like, you can relax. Like, just take a break sometimes. You know what I'm saying? So, but, you know, for him, it's like, no, I can never let, you know, another man outwork me, or never a day where I feel like, you know, I'm not getting better and somebody else getting better than me. You know, a lot of guys say they want to be great but don't want to put in the work.
Michael, is there really that big of a difference between AD and, like, you, for instance? Like, what's the difference between you and AD? How is he different? How is
his
he next
grind
level?
His grind is different. His grind is different. You know, I mean, he has two kids. He has a family. You know, he loves his kids. But, you know, for me, I'm going to take a little vacation and maybe go to a Disney park or something like that. And, you know, he will too. But he's going to definitely make sure he gets that work in before he do anything.
Michael Brocker is joining us. I can appreciate it. So it's a really challenging time right now for everybody when it comes to staying in shape because gyms and practice facilities are closed. So how are you going about approaching that?
I'm taking it back to my roots, man. I have a coach who coached me in middle school and a little bit of high school. And we just get it in my front yard, man. I can't make any excuses. Like I said before, AD motivates me, man. I'm watching his little videos, and I'm like, okay, yeah. I can't let a day go by where I feel like, oh, he's getting better than me or you know, he's outworking me. So that's definitely something I got from him, just, you know, to have that integrity, you know, all year round where you're always working and you're never having a day off.
Yeah, in the event that anybody's not following this, AD is Aaron Donald. Now, before you entered free agency, you talked about the fact that you weren't necessarily sure what kind of respect that you might get from other teams because they might be distracted by what AD does. Now, he raves about what you do against the run, and then one NFL scout told ESPN before free agency that you are, quote, one of the best versus the run, the way you're able to anchor versus a double team. He has a great strength at the point of attack. He's always penetrating gaps, and he's durable. End quote. So what's it mean to you to hear that kind of respect that you do have around the league and from your teammate?
Definitely honored because, you know, I just put in my work, man. I don't try to go out there and, you know, chase numbers or anything like that, man. I go out there and play my game, and that's what I love about playing for the Rams. They don't, you know, it's not a lot of pressure, man. You just go out there and do your job at the best of your ability and win games, and that's the most important thing, and that's my game is going in, handle those double teams, you know, being as disruptive as I can.
He has started 57 straight games, coming off a career-high 63 tackles. He had 3 sacks last season, and he did re-sign with the Rams on Friday. Michael Brocker is my guest. Michael, I appreciate you. Great to have you back. Congrats on that new deal, and always good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Man, I appreciate you. Thank you for having me on, man. And, man, stay safe.
Molly Seidel is my guest. Molly, it's so nice to have you on. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Super to have you. So normally we'd be talking about the Olympics right now, but and what you accomplished in Atlanta and your preparations for Tokyo, but given that it's been postponed for a year, you did support USA Track and Field's call to postpone the games, but at the same time, how challenging is it to know that you have to wait another year, and how are you approaching that?
Yeah, it's definitely disappointing with the postponement, but I think in the end, this is 100% the right call for the IOC and our track governing body here in the U.S., USATF. It's just really not, I don't think it's reasonable to expect people to be going out in 4 months and competing at the Olympic Games when we're still really in the thick of it with coronavirus worldwide. So it's presenting a new set of challenges with training, but I'm trying to look at it as an opportunity. I get a full extra year now to try and get a little bit better at the marathon distance, because kind of like you said, I've only done one at this point. So it might be a cool opportunity for me to try and race another one, maybe like a New York or a Chicago or Boston Marathon in the fall, and then just see where we are by next summer when we finally get to do the games.
You can follow her at ByGollyMolly12 on Twitter, which I love. Molly Seidel is joining us. Now, you made the point that you were able to do your training and your qualifying at a time before coronavirus could impact you. Could you imagine training and preparing for the trials or the Olympics themselves at this point? I mean, how impossible would that be?
Well, that's the challenging thing. Before the games were officially postponed, many of my friends and other fellow pro runners here in Boston, where I live and train, were trying to do just that, because the games were still set to go this summer. They were worrying that they weren't going to be able to do the Olympic trials or to train. Basically, every competition had been canceled, and they were putting their own safety basically on the line, just trying to go out and train every day. Every track has been closed. Every gym has been closed. I just don't really see how it would have been possible for them to stay healthy while trying to train for something of this magnitude. So I'm very glad for the postponement for their sake. So mostly right now we're all kind of just in a holding pattern, trying to do our runs but not really train for anything specific and just get through the worst of this.
Molly Seidel is my guest. Now, you've got an amazing story, and I want to get into it in a moment so people truly understand what you've accomplished, because you've been working at a coffee shop. There's this angle that you're a barista who qualified for the Olympics the first time she entered a marathon. I mean, it's pretty funny, but it's not the whole story. So if we were to go all the way back, how did you first get into running, and what was it about the sport that you liked so much?
Yeah, I first got into it actually through my church growing up. We didn't have a track team at my school. I went to a very, very small school. So my CCD was letting kids train with their track team. And so I hopped in, found that I was pretty good at it, and then kind of just continued from there, went through into high school and ended up winning a few state titles and eventually the national championship my senior year, and got a scholarship through college. So I think the media kind of jumped on this idea of, oh, yeah, this plucky barista who never ran before just, like, qualified for the Olympics. But I think it's
incredible.
The story's a little bit more complicated than that.
Amazing.
I am a professional runner, but I work a side hustle just to kind of make ends meet, because running isn't exactly the most lucrative of sports.
It is really a funny story that you just kind of jumped out there and, hey, I think I'll try this little marathon thing. But the fact is, you're kind of underselling this. You had an amazing high school career in Wisconsin, which included winning all 4 1600 and 3200 runs in track and field. You set state records in both. You won 4 cross country titles. You won the Foot Locker cross country championships in 2011. So how would you describe your experience running in high school?
Yeah, I would say running in high school, it was Wisconsin isn't a huge state, so I don't want to say too much that it was like a big fish, small pond, but definitely, like, going from high school to college was definitely that next step up. It was a lot higher of competition. I think in high school I got kind of used to being able to go out and easily win races, and then when you move up to that next level, it's definitely a lot harder when you're now against all the best runners in the country who are all the best in their states. So, yeah, I think each time I've gone up a level, there's kind of an adjustment period of like, okay, get used to this next level, learn how to do this and respond.
Molly Seidel is my guest. So you go to Notre Dame and you arrive with a lot of hype. And as you mentioned, there's a whole different level and a whole different challenge in running in college. A lot of it's great, but there's some really harmful and some unhealthy body image issues that could come along with that. If, Molly, you're comfortable talking about that, can you discuss what that experience was like for you?
Yeah. I think the sport of running is one that kind of has a little bit of a dark side in that definitely perpetuates this idea that to be faster, you need to be skinnier or smaller, and that the people who succeed in the sport are those who can keep their body weight the lowest. And that leads to a lot of disordered eating. And for me, it really did kind of highlight some of these underlying problems that I've had with OCD and anxiety throughout my life, accentuated that. And it did kind of manifest itself as an eating disorder. I won my national championships, but right after that was sidelined with repeated injury. My weight had dropped about 20 pounds over the course of about a year or so when I was winning these national championships. And it eventually got to the point where I had to seek medical treatment for eating disorder recovery. And it's something that I've dealt with now off and on for the last several years, and something that I still have to pay a lot of attention to. But I'm hoping that my story and the fact that I faced this, overcame it, and now I'm back running at a high level can help other women who are going through it, who may be in college right now, suffering from this, believing that they have to be the absolute lowest body weight to succeed. And I hope that I can show them, like, no, I'm actually running faster now that I'm a higher body weight than I was in college, but I'm stronger and I'm healthier, and that's what's letting me succeed.
You know, I so appreciate you sharing that, and there's no telling how many people have been helped by your willingness to share that. You know, the story goes that you competed at the 2016 Olympic trials because you were dealing with a stress fracture. At that point, a teammate from Notre Dame told you that you did not look well. What do you remember about that?
Yeah, that was really kind of my rock bottom moment. It wasn't even that I didn't look well. It was she basically told me that I looked like I was dying. And at that point, I was 95 pounds, like 20 pounds down from my normal weight. And my bones were repeatedly breaking. And that was the wake-up call that I kind of needed. I'd been in a little bit of denial leading up to that point. And her being able to say that from someone that I really trusted and like from one of my best friends was kind of the impetus for me to finally go and get help. And I'm not going to lie, like eating disorder treatment was pretty much the hardest thing I've ever gone through, but I'm glad that I did. And I'm glad that I had people around me who cared about me as a person rather than as a runner and wanted me to be healthy and have a good life, regardless of whether or not it affected my running.
Molly Seidel is my guest. And one more thought about that, because the story goes you left sponsorship money on the table so you can make that decision and take care of yourself. I think a lot of people in your position might have tried to push on through, ignored everything, and just taken that money. Why didn't you?
I think I had a really good support network around me. I had, kind of like I said before, people who were looking out for me more as a person rather than as a runner. And like my parents really couldn't care whether or not I'm running. They want me to be healthy at the end of the day, and they want me to be happy. And so being able to have people like that in my life who are able to let me see, like, okay, if you don't get fully mentally and physically healthy now, it's going to affect you the rest of your life, and you probably won't be running a year or two from now if you don't solve this right now. So I'm glad that I had those people around me. But yeah, it was one of the hardest decisions I've ever had to make. And truthfully, at the time, I felt like I was giving up on my pro running career. It's hard when you're it feels like you're sitting at the bottom of a well and looking up and wondering how you're going to get out of it. And it just seems impossible. And it's kind of just one step at a time.
One step at a time, one day at a time. You did all the hard work, and then you came back, and then in December, you qualified for the Olympic trials with a really strong showing at the Rock and Roll Half Marathon in San Antonio, including getting a cool fist bump from a young girl at mile 11. What was the plan going into that race, both for the race and the upcoming few months, and then how did that change based on the result?
Yeah, truthfully, going into those races, I had a very open mind about it. I had never done the half marathon. I really didn't know what to expect. And so when I went and did well at the San Antonio half, going into it, my coach and I hadn't really even planned on doing the Olympic trials. I was set to debut at a different marathon, actually. And we kind of talked it over, thought it would be a really cool experience to go for the Olympic trials. Just because I'm so young, we didn't really anticipate that I would be very competitive. Usually women are more competitive in their late 20s or early 30s at the marathon. So going into it, and then with the half in Houston, when I ran a better time than I did in San Antonio, kind of this slow build of like, okay, like maybe I can do this. Maybe like training is going well, like kind of raising the expectation each time. But even the day before the race, my coach, when we were sitting down, was like, okay, worst case scenario, you get probably 15th tomorrow. Best case scenario, you maybe get third. So it was definitely out of the blue to find myself in second place going into mile 20. And like, okay, now you really like are in it and you've got to commit to this.
Talking to Molly Seidel, then as you mentioned, you did run faster at the Houston half in January. You ran with Molly Huddle. And then you had an Instagram post the other day that read, before the Houston half back in January, I was worried my training was not enough, that I couldn't work out as hard as veteran marathoners did. A really smart friend sitting next to me on the bus started to say something. Who was that friend, and what did that friend tell you?
So the friend sitting next to me on the bus over to the start line in Houston was Alphine Tillamook, who is the winner of the women's Olympic trials. And she's definitely she's a close friend of mine, someone I look up to enormously, and she's been through her own share of struggles. She had been through a severe stress fracture in her sacrum and come back from that, and basically she told me, like, your training isn't going to be like anyone else's because you're not like anyone else. Like, you can't keep comparing yourself to all these women. You need to just focus on what you can do. And that meant a lot coming from her, who's someone that I see as an enormously successful runner. And so being able to have her there with me for those final 6 miles in the marathon trials, not only the advice that she had given me in the past, but then that support that she gave me over those final 6 miles when we weren't racing, we were working together to get to the finish line and to make that team together. It was really special.
I was gonna say, Molly, so what was that like? So when you're working with her for the last 6 miles, and given all the work and everything you had to come back from to finish the trials, to hit the finish line, she's waiting for you there, you know you're headed to the Olympics, what was that moment like?
It was just a sense of like, it's been my dream since I was a little kid to make an Olympic team. And it's I think, every runner's ultimate dream to be able to wear the USA singlet in the Olympics. And so crossing that line, it's just this enormous sense of, like, relief and accomplishment. One, relief because you don't have to run anymore. You finally get to rest. But also just, like, wow, like, I can't believe that actually happened. And just this, like, washing over of, like, happiness. Like, Alfian's there, who's been working with me so hard over the last 26.2 miles. My family is there waiting for me. My coach is there, and he's been, like, just through it with me. And it meant so much because, like, all of these people who had meant so much to me and helped me get to that point were all there to celebrate it with me. It was a really, really fun, special moment.
Yeah, beautiful. Let me ask you this before you go. So, like, at the end of the marathon, your first marathon, what was more challenging? Was it managing, I would imagine, the inevitable physical pain, or maybe the emotion of the moment in the end?
Yeah, I think it's probably both because, so, like, obviously when you're getting to mile 20 of a marathon, you're so tired and you still have 10 kilometers to go, you still have a lot of racing left, and your legs don't want to move, but you know you have to keep pushing. And then also realizing, oh my gosh, I'm in second place. And trying to not psych myself out at that point, not to think too much, and not to think of all of the women who are very fast that I'm ahead of, and thinking like, oh my gosh, Desiree Linden, who is the Boston Marathon winner, three-time Olympian, is right behind me. Sally Kipiego, who's a world silver medalist, is right behind me, and not freaking out and being able to say, okay, I'm just going to focus on what I need to do right now and to just stay with Alphine and just run my race right now. If they catch me, they catch me. It's fine. Just go with it. And so, yeah, trying to manage both the mental stress and the just physical pain you're going through. It's a balancing act.
Oh, amazing. All right, so finally, you posted on Instagram, quote, I've waited my whole life for this moment to make the Olympics safer for everyone. I'm willing to wait a bit longer. So how do you go about approaching the next year in preparation for the Olympics?
Yeah, so right now we're just kind of trying to get through this very difficult time. I'm in Boston right now, and obviously we're kind of under a lockdown. So it's just going day to day and not trying to plan too far in the future. Hopefully if things open up by the fall and there are races being held, we'll start to put together a race schedule, some distances between the 10K and the marathon, and then hopefully culminate with a bigger marathon later in the fall. And then we'll see as we go into next spring. It's a world cross country championship here that's in Australia. So we'll potentially think about trying to qualify for that team. And then, yeah, just really gearing up for a long marathon build leading into Tokyo. So it'll be preparation and require a lot of flexibility with the current state of the world. But yeah, I think I'm pretty good with dealing with unknown. So we'll just try and ride it out.
She is a member of the U.S. Olympic team. She was a four-time national champion at Notre Dame and All-American as well, and did finish second at the Olympic marathon trial in her very first marathon. Molly, so nice to meet you. What a great conversation. What a great story. I'm so glad that you shared it with us and our listeners, and really nice to have you on the program, Molly. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for the vine, Jim. Jim, my beef is with all that superfluous nonsense that Matt in L.A. wraps around the meat of his calls. Matt, your calls remind me of that phenomenon called enrichment at the zoo. You know, when instead of just giving the tiger his meat, they wrap it up in multiple layers of paper and cardboard, and the moment or two that it takes the tiger to tear through it is supposed to enrich his life by reminding him of tearing through an animal's fur. Well, Matt, let me tell you exactly what that tiger wants to tell his zookeeper. Hey, dum-dum, fur tastes like crap. Why the hell would you want to remind me of that? You must have been absent from zookeeper school the day that they taught that animals don't take showers. We spend all day sweating in the hot sun until our fur stinks like hell. And if you thought we smelled bad, taste some fur, bro. Not only is fur foul tasting, it also gets stuck in our teeth. And newsflash, dum-dum, animals don't have dental floss in the wild. And even if we did, we don't have an opposable thumb to manipulate it. Listen, you idiots, we like chasing the animal. We like eating the meat. But chewing through fur is a pain in the ass. You've literally chosen one of the few things from the wild that I hate as quote-unquote enrichment. Please tell me your next brilliant idea for enrichment isn't to import a bunch of mosquitoes into my cage to remind me of how they used to annoy the hell out of me in the wild. Seriously, zookeeper, feel free to replace all that paper and cardboard with some béarnaise sauce. Anyways, Jim, the point is, Matt in L.A., all that unnecessary wrapping around the meaty portion of your calls, it doesn't enrich me, it enrages me. Stop burdening me with that annoying bullcrap and just give me my damn meat. Yo, Romeo, from reaching over trays and cell block D to my job cleaning trays at Mickey D's, you're welcome. Hey, DA, see how I just crushed Matt in L.A. and it only took 90 seconds?
Jim O's, first of all, God bless you and yours. Thanks for the vine. From Detroit to Deutschland. From Southfield to South America, you're welcome. Especially you, Jeffy, you wisecracking weirdo. The CBS Sports Net, in conjunction with Jim Rome's Jungle, is doing its part in keeping the sanity of America together during this pandemic. No thanks to this mediocre YouTube miscreant with the imbecilic impersonations, gibberish jabberjaws, and nonsensical non-sports takes. Pipe down, you nincompoop. Hey, yo, Jeff in Southfield, stick to spouting off about Arthur Fonzie, American cheese, and whatever else you Michigan malcontents talk about as you pass your boarded-up boulevards and run down ramshackle roads, you rabble-rouser. You keep worshiping me from afar, and I'm going to get my dude Josh in Detroit to bore you to death via phone call. Bitch smack you, you chump. You stand-up comic wannabe, open mic reject, YouTube yokel freak. I was just a taste for you, you trailer park tailgater. Aloha means hey hola. You amateur. I'm the Twilight Zone marathon of smack. You better have catalogs of smack for this fight, son. War Dave Roberts leading the Dodgers to the promised land in 2020. Unwar murderer Carol Baskins. Unwar clones with no game taking a run at the legendary Matt in L.A. Ouch, bro.
Parody, Larry. All right, Larry, you've been on hold 3 weeks. What is your beef, Larry?
Hey, Ron, how you doing? I hope you're all safe. I got a beef with the state of Nebraska, Jim, because they keep sending us this terrible emailer and potential caller, and with a response to Kenny Rogers, on a cold winter's morning, on a train bound for Lincoln, I met a clone named Geoff. We started talking about Jim Rome. I said, if you don't mind my saying, boy, you got to step your game up. Because if you want to call the jungle, let me give you some advice. You got to know when you're on hold'em. Don't suck is what Tucker told him. You better have a take or you'll get run. You never...
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
So Ritt got to run parody, Larry. How'd that feel, old man? Let's go to Lincoln, Nebraska. Hey, everybody deserves a chance to respond. Geoff. What's up, Geoff?
Why? How's it going, man?
Good. How about you?
Doing good. Hey, parody Larry calling me out and giving me advice on how to call is rich. So I got some advice for him. Use a parody from this century, dude. Maybe a little Lizzo. Larry's calls are up. Oh, when he called, he dropped a deuce in his pants. He dropped a deuce because his...
Anytime, Rich.
No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
The beef that nobody asked for. Geoff and parody, Larry.
Good night now!